Hello, welcome to ATM, Artist Talk Movies, a podcast interviewing creatives about films that have inspired and or influenced their personal studio work. I'm Hyde Fontenot, and I'm here with co-host Aaron Stafford.
We're here to talk about contemporary art and the creative impulse with new guests each episode. We're having casual conversations.
We don't pretend to be authorities.
We're hoping to give you a window into the visionary process of makers.
I've come to speak to you about a tournament of martial arts.
Roper!
What's your style?
You can call it the art of fighting without fighting.
Where do you come from?
Well, hi. It's been a while. I miss you so much. I know you're in Ireland.
Right.
Lucky.
While the rest of the world is experiencing record heat, I'm in this place where I need a jacket and a hat and a
scarf. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So I feel a little guilty, although I did plan it. I was like, where would I like to be right now?
Oh yeah.
You know, I know the summer's always brutal, you know.
That reminds me of when we spent that summer in Canada when we thought it was gonna be really cold. And it was basically the Texas of Canada is where we ended up, which
And there were like 200 forest fires. Yeah.
Those
British Columbia. And the skies were orange from smoke. Yeah.
Oh, that was so weird. Yeah. I didn't see the Texas of Canada on the application. Otherwise, I don't think I would have applied to that one. But we had a good time. But
man.
I mean, I'm sure it's beautiful where you're at. Are you in a remote area? Or?
Yes. I'm on the Atlantic coast in Cork County. But I'm in a little... I'm outside. I'm like a 30-minute walk to a town called Skull that is spelled S-C-H-U-L-L. It's like I'm in bumfuck Ireland. But I rented a little cabin and I can make drawings here. And so I have what I need.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really cool.
Okay. So
was it kind of interesting watching this movie in Ireland? Like, was it just such a completely different culture? Cause it's kind of like American and Chinese kind of culture kind of coming together, but then you watched it in Ireland and then
I didn't think about that so much. So this week, listeners, we're talking about Enter the Dragon, the Bruce Lee film from 73. Okay. And I feel like that film would be a weird collision to watch almost anywhere.
True. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. In fact, you know, I'm new to the genre of the kind of action kung fu kind of, if you didn't already know. I thought there was going to be a dragon. Like, I didn't know that.
When's the fucking dragon entering?
The end came in. I was like, wait a minute. Where's the dragon? Oh, it's Bruce Lee. I think he was the dragon in the whole thing. But I didn't know that until the end. So,
I probably have seen this film, but I couldn't remember. Because as a teenager growing up in Louisiana, I would go to drive-in movies with my friends because it was kind of a place to go and get drunk in your car.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because we had very few options as to where can country kids hang out. So we'd go to drive-ins. Yeah. But shall I introduce our artist this week?
Yeah, do it.
All right. Adnan Razvi is a Texas-based artist and a proud father who, within his studio practice, concerns himself with Afro-Asian history and migration. bodily displacement, and ecology, specifically the value of water and our natural environment. His paintings are recognized for their beautiful calligraphic marks. His current body of work is on view at the Charles Adams Gallery in Lubbock, Texas. Welcome, mm-hmm. Adnan.
Thank you both so much for having me. Yeah, I am here. Can you both hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Where are you in Dallas, Adnan?
Yeah, currently I'm in Dallas, Texas. I have basically working out of my house, so painting, it's quasi like house studio, So I've been here for quite a while.
All right.
I was gonna ask you. I think that this movie, Enter the Dragon, is like kind of a cult favorite with like a certain older generation. Is this like, as kind of a younger, cooler person, when were you first introduced? Like, was it for your,
when did the dragon enter you?
Well, first off, I'm glad to think, I'm glad you think I'm pretty cool. But, when I was a kid, when I was a kid, my mother's side of the family, they immigrated from East Africa, so from Uganda, and they ended up kind of on the north side of Chicago, right outside the Cabrini Green Project. So they were just, real inner city kids. And I think, once they came to America, it was really all the rage, right? Inner city African American kids and African kids and Latino and Asian kids really kind of embraced Enter the Dragon because it was, just someone that wasn't like a part of like homogenous perception. It wasn't like a Caucasian superhero or an action hero. It was an Asian person. So, when I was a kid, it was, it was something my own family, my own uncles, they looked up to this superhuman almost, Bruce Lee. And, so when I was a kid, I would say that was when I was first introduced to the film.
Yeah.
I mean, it totally has like, it just feels like something that a dad or an uncle would put on. I know that my boyfriend, he said this is one of his dad's favorite movies.
Really?
And I just, I didn't know. But like that, looking, I was like, that totally makes sense that he would like this movie. It felt like maybe some sort of like familial, kind of thing. But
Hey Adnan, I want to ask while we're on the subject of this film choice, like what were some of the other films you were considering talking about? Because I want to know if they're within this genre or if
that's a great question. So I tend to like action films, and I guess like when I was a kid, I grew up on a lot of I was always the youngest in my family, so it was always like my elders kind of playing movies, and they would get really hyped about Bruce Lee films, or they're really into like Steven Seagal and a lot of these they're really really extra actors. But looking back at it, I never really embraced them as much as I did Bruce Lee, let's say, because I just feel like the perseverance that he showed was really, really amazing. He actually wrote a really cool book called it was a compilation of his writings called The Tao of Jeet Kune Do. Have you guys ever heard of that? Yeah, it's a book of his writings and his just basically his philosophies, and that's really why people that were like super into him were really into more so his philosophy and his way of thinking. For instance, like he'd say things like, how you train is through like everyday habits. For instance, parking really far away in a parking lot and making yourself walk, not taking the elevator, taking the stairs, really allowing yourself to embrace the idea of being able to accomplish anything.
Yeah.
That's so cool. I feel like that also, like that kind of physical exercise can also maybe translate as an artist, like kind of seeing things in a way, like kind of opening your eyes and kind of letting like, these moments are kind of taking in information that maybe other, like mindfulness. I hate to use that word because I feel like it gets thrown out a lot, but I feel like there's like a weird parallel there. But could you, Anand, give our listeners a brief summary of Enter the Dragon for folks who maybe haven't seen it or haven't seen it in a while?
No, yeah, no, sure. I'd love to. So basically, it starts with the main character, who's Bruce, played by Bruce Lee, and it's all about a well, it starts out with like a training tournament, and it enters, you know, him fighting basically like individual, and you later find out he's a teacher, and he has a student, and so he's kind of starts out with like a more of like a peaceful journey, or, you know, peaceful way of thinking, but then his father tells him a story, right, of his sister being attacked by one of these fighters that are from this tournament, and then she ends up killing herself. So it's really a powerful kind of message. So from there, he gets approached by I guess the government, who says this man who's running this fighting tournament is basically, you know, running drugs and like some sort of like prostitution ring or something along these lines, and he's basically sent there to investigate. So it's kind of twofold in terms of him wanting to go there and figure out what's happening on the island. So once he gets to the island, you know, he fights, you know, a variety of people. He meets other characters as well, who are there for, you know, their own reasons. And it kind of gives a backstory for them as well, which is really cool. So he basically, you know, fights his way through, you know, through the island. And he finds out that they are indeed running, it seems like, drugs. And they have like a prostitution ring, and they're like enslaving like these Asian workers to work forcibly, and it's really kind of amazing to think like a film that old would embrace like these themes, right? But so basically, totally. Near the end of it, you know, he busts the ring, he fights the main character, and to spoil it, he wins.
Yeah,
it's a it's an insane movie in like a really good way. Like there are so many like. Can you talk a little bit about the sounds of the movie? Like, I feel like that was such a big part of.
Oh sure, like, yeah. That's one thing that always gets me. Like, right, the sounds, and also just the different like kind of abstract scenes of like the boat. So yeah, I really love like the music they play when, you know, it's building up to fights, when he, for instance, he's trapped in this really cool room near the end where it's like a room full of mirrors, right? And it's almost, I don't know if you guys remember that, but it's almost like you feel the feeling of the main character as he's about to fight the antagonist, right? And you hear the sounds kind of building up, you see the mirrors moving, and then it's almost like animalistic in a sense when he attacks and fights, you feel that at the same time, and it's really fantastic, how they kind of pair all the images with them, you know, riding through the boats and kind of arriving to the different ships as they, you know, as he gets to the main boat to go to the island to fight, you see him, how they use music and sound to, for him to recollect, like, you know, old memories and things of this nature. So yeah, I just thought it was really, really cool how they, put each scene together and how they kind of built up that suspense for you to really, be involved in the story. Yeah.
Can we talk about Bruce Lee for a minute? Because sure. Like his body in this movie.
Oh yeah.
What on, like, there's no body fat on his body. It's just like, it's all muscle and bone or something. Like, it's so crazy. I didn't know.
Aaron, you need to calm down right now.
He was, can you be horny
after
y'all?
After we record?
I mean, no. He was, I found this out. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious, but like, he's an actual like martial arts expert.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I just thought he was an actor. But like, it's very clear that like he has skills along with like the other cast members, like Jim Kelly, who plays the Williams, who's like the cool suave black guy with the afro, and then there's another guy, Roper.
Yeah, they
go, how do y'all say his name?
Recall the Roper? Names. Yeah.
Anyway, he's the kind of sleazy, white guy who gambles and like is kind of in some trouble financially.
Yeah.
But like, they, I think those other two actors, along with maybe a few others, like, also were recruited because they have like these skills sure. in Kung Fu.
Yeah, so
which
I think
is pretty cool.
Very cool. No, you're right. And I think so Bruce Lee was actually a very very, very skilled martial artist, and I think he used to train I think it was Jim Kelly and I believe the other actor, I think it was John Saxon, I think. And so he used to train them and a few other actors on basically how to fight. So Bruce Lee himself, he trained in, I believe it was in Wing Chun. He trained under Ip Man. So he was a grandmaster from, I can't remember where exactly in China. And I think he taught Bruce Lee as a teenager, and then I believe he got in a lot of fights with gangs, and he had to immigrate to the U.S. and that's kind of where he started teaching other people. Yeah, and it's really cool about Bruce Lee is he in the movies he filmed they actually had to slow down the motion of his speed, so they had to put it in slow motion so they could catch it because he was so quick that they would never be able to see him fight. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he was, like, crazy with his move. I didn't know that. That's insane that he slowed down because, like, it was very quick, the movements. I mean, and I was actually, sometimes I'll, when I get the courage, I'll teach some gesture drawing in my drawing classes. And I'm always thinking, like, what are some, like, gestures of the body that would be fun to draw? And I just kept thinking about that with Bruce Lee in this movie because, like, they're so dynamic. You know, you could watch this movie and, like, probably really learn gesture drawing pretty well. I would have. In fact, I might just do that next semester.
Yeah, that sounds like a cool assignment. Yeah.
I know. Right?
Pausing a kung fu film. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. At least I would be the cool professor who showed Enter the Dragon for a class. Anyway.
Sure.
But that's wild. But yeah, he was like hardcore devoted, martial arts expert, and it shows. Like, he's kind of a badass in this movie. Yeah. It's crazy.
So, Adnan, before you came on, Erin and I were discussing the film, and she was saying she kept waiting for the dragon. Do you recall, is there mention of a dragon specifically, or is that, I mean, not that it's a real dragon, but it's like, I know, like, with Chinese zodiac and horoscope, the dragon is within that, within those symbols, and it's the most auspicious sign.
Yeah.
And do you know if Bruce Lee was a dragon, or is there, I missed the reference to dragon, if there is a direct reference.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a direct reference. And if there is, I probably miss it as well. But I think what you're saying is 100% correct. Like the strength of the dragon, the significance of the dragon. I think he himself probably, I'm assuming that he represented that. So
what I did find out was that there was a lot of conflict between the studio and Bruce Lee with like how the film was presented, and then even the title. So they wanted to call it something else, the studio. But Bruce Lee, I think what I remember is that he was concerned that they were going to sort of re-edit the film so that John Saxton, the white guy, I think was going to be more of a dominant focal point, like the protagonist. And he was worried that with a kind of more neutral sort of, I think it was like chains and ropes. Oh crap, I totally forget y'all. But it was something like really generic and bland a little bit. Yeah. And then he insisted the title was Enter the Dragon so that they couldn't change it because like John Saxton was not going to be the dragon. Like that would be weird, I guess.
Right. Yeah. So, no, that's a good point. Yeah, no.
There are some like other like funny stories that I found out about this movie that kind of like really kind of like shed a lot of light on some kind of cultural sort of racism that was happening when this movie was made. And I don't know if you know this, Anon, but the guy, Jim Kelly, the character whose name was Williams, with the crazy afro, like awesome character.
Yeah.
That he was not supposed to die. Did y'all know that?
Oh, I didn't know that.
No.
Yeah, what? So what? he his character was not supposed to die. It was going to be John Saxton's character, but because John Saxton was kind of a bigger movie star, he didn't like that. So that they switched it, and that Williams is, he died and not Robert.
That's interesting in negotiating your contract. It's like,
isn't that weird? Like, what kind that's super of weird. Actor is like, I don't want to die. Like, you think that'd be...
You realize it's a movie, right, guy?
It's a movie,
Yeah.
We're not really going to kill you.
Yeah. No, that's crazy. I didn't know that. And it's really cool because, you know, this film has, you know, just like you said, it has a strong cultural, you know, implication. It has a strong, you know, if you think about the year 1973 or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot going on, right, in America. There's a whole lot going on. And I think it was very significant that, you know, Bruce Lee himself was playing this almost like a hero role, right? This was groundbreaking during the time where, you know, most Asian people were kind of typecast within, you know, a certain presentation. And people the same like, goes with African Americans, and
I was gonna say people like Yul Brynner were playing Asian, like in, Ernest Borgnine, I think, was playing. Who was? Oh, John Wayne played Genghis Khan.
Oh my god!
Around that time.
Yes. You know, like
they weren't casting Asians,
right?
In Asian roles.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, you know, this is really kind of groundbreaking on kind of breaking that stereotype and just saying, you know, kind of kicking down the door figuratively and saying, here we are, right? And I think a lot of people were, you know, really taken to that, and you know, there are also a segment of people that were taken aback by it.
Yeah, I think that this movie, like, really, I know this movie influenced a lot of different, like, music and video games and, like, Kung Fu was really popular after that. Like, it totally, like, infiltrated, you know. In fact, okay, this is a crazy factoid that I found out, but do y'all remember, I kind of like the villain a little bit, Han, who was like an Epstein kind of, I was like, is this Epstein, but like from the
70s? I see. Not Weinstein, Epstein. Oh, Epstein. Yeah, right, surrounded by women,
Yes, right. And like drugs and an island, anyway, but...
Right. Like so international waters. Yeah. Like
Yes.
Yeah.
So
why do you need to live on a private island, right?
I know. But this Han's villain character, I don't know if it's like if this stereotype had already been established or if it was like reinforcing the kind of villain, like Bond kind of stereotype with the kitty cat.
Oh my
like
god. Yes. Dr. Evil. It was like I know that Michael Myers.
Michael
riffed
off
of that in Austin Powers by holding the white fluffy cat and
And then didn't Austin, y'all, I'll talk all day long about Austin Powers, but in that movie, wasn't there like a scene where he had like the laser sharks or like the lasers attached to the sharks and they were swimming? Yeah. But in the movie, they had a den with like some sort of little pond thing happening. But my favorite part of this Hans guy was that he could like remove and like his hand, was like missing. So he had all these like attachments that he could sort of, and then one of them,
like a vacuum cleaner.
One of them though was like a furry thing with like a spiky part.
Yeah.
And this.
And it looked like it was made in shop class. It was very clean. It was like.
Yeah, quick and easy.
It was not a very believable or comfortable looking prosthetic. Yeah.
But it was, but it was like, I guess maybe for the 70s, maybe it was a little menacing. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But this evidently became like a toy.
What?
That like this, I know. And it was the best selling Christmas present for children.
Oh, wow.
Until 1996.
Oh, wow.
What?
I get. That's what this little fact, anyway, which I'm not sure if I completely believe this, but yeah. They say, and if y'all out there
on the island of Guam.
Yeah, on the island of Guam. Yeah.
I don't recall this as a toy. Also, was it sharp? I mean, it's like a Freddy Krueger hand.
Well, yeah. You know what? Toys used to be insane.
Yeah,
like,
I was about to say, if it's from the 70s, it's probably a sharp.
Yeah.
Lawn darts. But... Do you know what lawn darts are?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
There were actual murders. Unintentional manslaughter, I should say.
Oh, yeah. That shit is dangerous. I mean, we had like toys. I know that there were toys that had like actual like chemicals that could like combust and all sorts of crazy shit. Mm-hmm. But if listeners, if you have one of these little furry pointy things, so a recent one in 2006 sold for $2.6 million. Wow.
What?
Now, it's in mint condition, but, like, they're very valuable, evidently.
It's a fucking toy. Well, okay, if you think about who's rich right now, it's like, who has $1 million to spend on a vintage toy? It's probably some dweeb like Zuckerberg.
Oh, yeah, right?
He's like, yeah, I want one of those. I don't care what it costs.
Yeah.
What, build a hospital? No, I want that toy.
Little furry. Yeah. but yeah, he was kind of a great villain because there's nothing like full on like evil villain. Like mm-hmm. It was this perfect stereotype. You know?
Yeah, it was really cool. He was a monk before, right? So he started as a monk in the story.
Right.
And then so it's like this progression from like good to like, I'm going to say evil, but like kind of like this transition of a character, right? I mean, they don't expand too much on him, but he's like, he was a monk and he went bad.
Yeah. Does that have like a religious thing? Because I know Satan was supposed to be an angel and then transitioned.
Oh, right.
You know.
And then he's like, I'm going to get my own island and move all these drugs and women. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I was going to say, Adnan, I think it's okay if you want to call him evil.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
He is like women are washing up on the shores of San
Francisco. Yeah. It's probably pretty bad.
I think it's okay.
Yo, what was up with that scene? It was like, so Dr. Evil or Han or whatever we want to call him.
Yeah.
He was confronting Williams about like sneaking out at night. And I guess this was not allowed. I'm not exactly sure why, but like obviously. Right.
They were sequestered as they were guests, but they couldn't leave their rooms at night. And that's why that he had the hookers come in and offer hospitality.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay. I thought that was just like a normal, like you're on an island with Epstein and you know.
Oh, right.
But, I didn't know that was like.
Like, why else are you here? Here's your hooker.
Oh, but I guess they could be watched too that way. So that makes sense. But
yeah, that's a good point. And it's cool, even in that scene, I think Bruce Lee was outside, and I think he didn't basically tell on him, right? So that
shows a bond. Because he did see him, I think. He saw, Lee, for those who might not be familiar, Bruce Lee does sneak out at night. Now, he is, you know, kind of successful in his, he ventures out to sort of do some reconnaissance.
Yes.
On the sort of situation that was happening anyway. But so Williams gets confronted because Dr. Evil thinks that he is but so they start kung fuing each other and of course Williams is like not
kung fuing.
They are. But then they like get into, they like smash through this wall and then they're in this like den, this like opium den of these women.
Like
it's totally
and,
like psychedelic or something.
Yes.
Very
yes.
much so. And I think that's when Han switches his hand out or something and it's like super hard and he like beats him unconscious or yeah, I believe that's what happened.
Yeah. It's very an indication of the decadence, like that these women are so stoned and incapacitated. And yeah, there are people having a fight in front of them and they're just too stoned to move and they're just kind of smiling and
laughing. Oh man. Well, I was going to say that there's a great Guardian article about this movie. If I don't know if y'all had discovered it, but the writer said that he felt like that was kind of like a weird, like if the director who did The Shining, Kubrick, like he said it felt like a Kubrick scene in the middle of this and I was like, yeah, it had Kubrick vibes, that whole sort of surreal, strange,
psychedelic
hippies. I thought that was a really great,
that's interesting, I never put that parallel together.
There's probably a lot to do with exoticism in this film too, where like say the general public would have a distrust of Asians or have these preconceptions of that they, well, of course they do opium, it's, you know, it's after five, you know, or but just like the menace from the East, you know, these ideas that well, maybe you could speak more to this, Emma.
Yeah, it's more like a post Vietnam like era, right? So we have all these stereotypes going on, right? So we have a lot of GIs coming home with you know, stories of, you know, they'd be using drugs, and you see a big push that, you know, came from, you know, these different places where you know, it was heavily starting to become heavily used in America. Now we can talk about who brought that in, or, you know, how that came to America, but yeah, it's definitely a very strong stereotype that was not true, right?
Yeah.
Well, and supply and demand, and, you know, I don't know if you, I won't get the facts of this quite right, but I'll just enter this in. Maybe you guys know more about it, but you know, when the British became interested in tea and it all came from China, they manipulated and produced opium as a drug, sort of pushing. How did that? It was like it had to do with shipping and trade, and they disabled part of the Chinese economy by introducing opium.
Oh my God! Jesus.
So that they could get tea cheaper,
or kind of
fuck with the I don't know, the market.
That's so interesting, because I don't know if you noticed, but whenever the one British fellow in this movie who's like setting this whole operation up, I think he's always drinking tea. So obviously that's probably not about
like
opium, but it's, he's like a very British kind of Braithwaite, I think is what it says on IMDb.
He's the one giving Bruce Lee the assignment to go to this tournament and do the spot.
Gosh, I'm not surprised that would have like happened, or that did happen, because like, oh my God, I mean,
And I think you're referencing the opium wars, right? So that was like in the mid 1800s, and basically like the British, they would trade they would give them opium and then they would give them tea, basically, and so they created like an addicted a wave of addicts.
Totally.
It's interesting to see these tactics used like as warfare, like it's like, it's not quite chemical warfare, but it's like how to hamstring someone that wants that has something you want, like say invented wars in the Middle East to gain control over oil reserves, or like we're always painting ourselves as liberators.
I mean, I think the British especially, you know, used a lot of different strategies to colonize, you know, indigenous people of, you know, different countries throughout the world, you know. You know, my grandfather, for instance, he was forcibly brought from Asia to East Africa to build railroads, right, by the British. So this was in the late 1800s, right? I mean, he was an old man, but I mean, they've been doing this for hundreds of years to many different countries and people, and
That reminds me, I was recently reading about the history of like diseases that happened with the Native Americans and the Europeans. Mm-hmm. And there's a misconception that like the diseases originated with the, I forget which one specifically. It's been a while since
smallpox?
I learned about this. I forget. There was one that like came back to and like infected, or maybe it infected Europeans in America, but it was actually the other way around. Like Europeans brought the diseases over, but it was this like weird like myth that started that it was the Native Americans when it definitely wasn't. So yeah. Like you have to be really careful. I always feel like really suspicious of any history. Like, you know, you have to do kind of a deep dive on it, because it's like, yeah, you don't know who's writing it and what their bias is.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's a great point, whoever's writing it. So, like, with indigenous mm-hmm. communities in America, I mean, Europeans knew it was biological warfare, so they knew exactly what they were doing when they were mm-hmm. you know, wiping uh-huh, people out. Uh-huh. But yeah, I mean, you make a really good point. Who writes history, and it's from their perspective, right? So for us here in America, oh, great, it's a free land. We have the 4th of July. It's so wonderful.
Yeah, look at America, free,
red, white,
right.
and blue. But red, white, and blue is almost a fearful image for Native peoples, for example, right? It's
oh,
a
God,
sign
yes.
of oppression. It's a frightening flag, right? Yeah. So it's all about perception.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I fucking hate the 4th of July. I'll say it. That's sure. my least favorite. I hate holidays.
Yeah.
I hate that holiday.
But it is interesting talking about symbols and how, like, the American flag and some people that are really mainstream can't imagine that strikes terror in the hearts of other people. And the same with, say, like, Christian symbols, like an ichthus or a crucifix. Like what that is seen as by some populations is like the ultimate, like moral good. And it's like, oh no, that's a sign of like, I'm about to be in trouble. I'm like, sure. I'm in danger right now. Yeah.
Oh yeah, no, symbology is just, it's huge. I mean, even with my own work, I mean, it explores like, you know, displacement and migration, but at the same time, you know, I'm making like really abstract forms that have associations to like African and Asian cultures. So I'll get a lot of people from these cultures who may automatically assume it relates to a certain, you know, certain religious connotation or subject, but it's way beyond that. It's actually the opposite of that, right? I'm tearing your I won't say dogmatic, but repetitive belief, and forcing you to kind of tear yourself outside of the box and look at something as just a form, right? And you know, it relates to history, it relates to culture and movement. But iconography, you can really, really form and shape people's perception with it. So, I mean, I agree with you. It's a powerful, powerful tool. Yeah.
Means vastly different things to different groups of people, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Adnan, you mentioned your grandfather and his sort of path of migration. And
sure.
I was just in a residency in Berlin with an artist from Milan, Italy, and her family were East Indian and brought to Africa as enslaved people. And I'm wondering if you share that ethnicity or that history. I'm not sure what she called herself ethnically. You know, she was Italian.
Yeah.
You know, she grew up in Italy. She speaks Italian, you know, but that's the lineage.
Right. No, that's a great question. I mean, like, I constantly question, you know, where I'm from or what I am, you know, all the time, right? It's like, are we even American, right? My grandfather, he was forcibly taken to East Africa, where he met my grandmother, who was a Ugandan woman, and after, I guess, they had forcibly, you know, finished the railroads, after that, they kind of resided there and remained there. So kind of both sides of my family experienced a lot of migration as well. So you know the British kind of did this around the world, right? They took people mm-hmm. from India. That's why you find a lot of South Asian people in Jamaica. You find them, you know, throughout okay. you know East mm-hmm. Asia, through many different places. For instance, Malaysia, right? Uh-huh. You have South Asian, Chinese, and Malay cultures kind of all mixed into one. It's all because of this, like, forced migration where we were, you know, taken.
So, your grandfather, now, you're not, are you in your 20s, Adnan?
I'm 36.
You are not. Oh, you're all lying. Right.
My all 36 right. or 36. You're lying. I'm horrible like... with age, yeah, yeah.
Because I was trying to do a little bit of quick math and think about sure. how old your grandfather is.
Oh, yeah, my grandfather, so my... Yeah, I mean, he was really old. So he, like, he actually passed away when my mom was, like, 13, and he was in his, like, 70s or 80s or something. So, unfortunately, he, like, okay, okay. he married my grandmother when she was, like, but really that, young. So, yeah. yeah.
But that was definitely in the 20th century that he mm-hmm. was enslaved.
Oh, yeah. It was in the 1800s, yeah.
Okay, okay.
Oh, so 19th century.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. He died, like, I think it was in the, oh, gosh, probably, it should have probably been in the 40s, 1940s or 50s. Okay, or okay. Around there.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah, gosh. I know that, like, your history and your identity are really, like, that's centered in your work and on.
Sure.
And I was thinking about how you have this like beautiful abstract quality in your work where you have kind of this, mm-hmm. like it's like a distortion, I guess. And I was mm-hmm. kind of thinking about how like the Hall of Mirrors in the movie kind of distorted yeah. the, and I like, there's that kind of psychedelic feel about both. And I was like, I really enjoyed like kind of picking up on some of the parallels between your work and like Bruce Lee, he also had some philosophy, a lot of philosophy that seems like it kind of relates to your practice as well.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't know, like I just,
yeah, there were moments in the film when there's like a mentorship happening and mm-hmm. advice given. And I was thinking like, oh, this could totally be taken into critique and applied to something else entirely.
Oh my god, yes, yeah. totally.
I wish I could quote from it, but I didn't make any notes because I'm lazy.
I have a few.
Yeah.
I have this one that I liked. It says, destroy the image and you will break the enemy. Mm-hmm. I think
wow.
I wrote that down right. I was like, whoa, that is so intense. And I can't remember, Anand, do you remember that quote from the movie?
Yeah, I think it's, I don't remember the exact quote, but I know exactly what you're talking about. And I think he said something along the lines of, like, you know, you don't hit, it hits. And it's kind of like a, to do this, like authentically, it's like your body and your mind move authentically when you engage or interact mm-hmm. or you need to focus on something, right? It's just so much training allows you to automatically kind of react. I think the movie was kind of like these kind of gems he dropped throughout the film, I think they, you know, the movie kind of played out like, you know, what he was referencing, right? Like mm-hmm. when you train or as an artist, right? When you have to have perseverance, you have to just kind of be authentically yourself and, mm-hmm. You know, yeah.
Oh, I wanted to ask you where some of these forms in your painting come from, because they mm-hmm. look, they look like letter forms. It looks like, yeah. Like type or like it looks. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So I got the idea, initially, you know, I studied a lot of history and I found out like in kind of earlier, I guess you could say like, Islamic African history in the 13th century, there were these, basically these like African clerics called marabouts, and they used to go around Africa and they would engage with like indigenous tribes there. And what they found is that they were making these like jade, amulets, and they would basically like carve in like abstract forms. So as a form of like cultural merging, what they did is these marabouts then started making their own, and they incorporated like abstract arabesque forms. And sometimes they would do like like religious writings in there. So I think for me, the relation of like, you know, migrating to America, well, you know, I was born here, but like, you know, a lot of us migrate here, right? So, or are born here or displaced here, whatever you want to call it. Through that, I realized I had my own sort of like understanding of, you know, cultural melding and like, you know, this exploration of who I am and where I stand in this country. And I think it speaks for a lot of people within this country. So I started thinking about, you know, what forms can I make to kind of merge this experience and kind of define what I am experiencing in this country through just like abstract kind of objects that I'm making, but I'm trying to also tie it into like narratives of like the past and the future, and like, you know, how can I use these tools to almost kind of restructure like how we view things. And in terms of like, you know, for instance, if someone is in, you know, kind of isolated or siloed within a community where they're seeing like these, like, you know, what they associate as, like we said, maybe religious writings or Arabesque forms. Uh-huh. And then I present this in a different way. What I've done is I've taken them out of that society, right? I've embraced them into like America. I've embraced them into like who they are and where we can be currently and in the future that they can create for themselves. It doesn't have to be just associated with one thing. So it's kind of creating tools almost for me.
So does it have any reference to, say, Islamic art, in that?
To say it does would align it to like a certain frame of thought, and I'm not aligning it to that frame of thought. I'm strictly kind of making it outside that channel of like, you know, any type of religiosity or Islamic association. But to say that I don't have that Islamic association just because of what I'm brought in and the subcultures that I'm exposed to, I mean, that would be false, right? To say, oh, it has nothing to do with this or has no association with this. Well, it does, so in a sense.
Yeah,
it's always interlinked, right? But here I am as, you know, someone that was born here, and I'm kind of creating a unique, authentic form of this within my own language and my own form that is completely removed from that, right? But but it's still, you know, you're still going to feel the energy of that.
Yeah. What did you think about the movie being mostly dubbed? Like, just thinking about language and like how language is formed, and this movie in particular was interesting because some of the actors didn't speak English.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if I've ever like seen a movie like that was like 100%, like, well, not 100%, but like 99%.
Yeah. A lot of films are dubbed like that. Yeah, Fellini would shoot with what they call like a scratch track. Like he would record film sound, knowing he wasn't going to use it. It was just used for the voice actors for dubbing. So there's discordant kind of quality in Fellini films too, where you know something's a little bit off, you feel it. But I wanted to say I watched an interview with Bruce Lee, and they asked him about dubbing and about different languages. And he said something kind of interesting and very telling about how he said that they're motion pictures. They're not. And so he felt like the action took precedence above dialogue. And that kind of was a punch in my stomach. But I was like, well, yes, he would say that because of his filmography, you know, that action
that's
is
a great point.
Yeah, is primary.
Yeah, no, agree.
Yeah, that totally makes sense.
But films that are like lower budget, that's a way to kind of work around is like dubbing, because it's like you have to have a really pristine working environment in the set to have usable sound,
right? And especially to capture it all effectively. Yeah,
so they were probably just like, we're moving, we got to keep going.
Because the budget was I think it was 90, what was it, it was like 100 $800,000. It was less than $1 million. Less than $1 million. I know that. And then it made like $90 million at the box office, which is just insane. I mean, wow. That's like Titanic level.
And with all the Foley sound and the action, too, they just, like, they had a different plan of production, just knowing that they're not going to use any of the real sound in the fight scenes, though, you know.
Yeah, although, like, I mean, it was almost sort of abstract in that way. Like, it just, it didn't seem real. And, like, all the sound effects and the witches and the, you know, it was just sort of like this, it didn't feel real. That wasn't, it's not a
like
bad
a layer
thing.
Of
it was
artifice.
Just,
Yeah, of course. It was his own world.
I didn't know that that was like, I mean, I don't know, but my boyfriend, he made this like sound effect and I was like, what was that? He was like, oh, you'll see. And I'm like, huh? I'm like, oh my God, it's every like half the movie. That's why I think it would be interesting if you just had the sound effects from this movie and that was it. It'd probably be an hour.
They're very extra. Yeah, no, definitely.
Yeah. But that, like, it was intense and it was like, it made sense for the movie and like, it was high energy, high drama. So it totally worked. But yeah, I just thought that was like an unexpected approach, but it does make sense now that Haiju kind of explained production cost and things like that. That I get it.
Yeah. And like Bruce Lee was saying, like dialogue was secondary, narrative was kind of secondary. And so, yeah, it's like, oh, you know, oh, let's get ready for the soliloquy. It's like, no, there is none.
I don't know why. I guess I just thought that like background noise, like how do they get background noise?
You can add like, like crowds and like clinking dishes, everything you like try to cut out in or isolate while you're actually trying to keep the sound, but you can add it in because then, well, you know, from maybe editing this podcast, it's like if there's an inconsistency, then that's jarring.
Right.
And they'll do really cool shit too. They'll lay down like I think I've seen this video where they like lay down like different vegetables and they'll like smack it and it'll create like this sound. And they'll do like a, you know, it's just super random things. And it's like, wow, that I never would have thought of that before. That's really cool.
Oh, like a head getting smashed in as like a melon.
Exactly. Yep.
Can I have that job? That sounds amazing. Just coming up with like weird sound effects all day.
Yeah, it's it's called a Foley artist. Yeah.
That's amazing. Wow. Yeah. I mean,
but you know, it is, but Adnan, like what you were saying, it's true about how like the sound, like if you, well, this sounds really macabre, but if you actually smash somebody's head in, probably doesn't sound that great. But if you smash a melon in, it sounds like fantastic. And so, like, a lot of times when you're shooting something, if you represent the real thing, like, you know, like in food photography, like instead of using milk because of what milk does under hot lights, it starts to clot and such. Currently. Like, people will use glue because it's like, like pouring milk. Is, you know, but it looks fantastic, even though it's not what it says it is.
Oh, I love that artifice. Cool. Yeah. That just makes me, I know that instead of ice cream, it's like mashed potatoes, which just
yes!
is so
Yeah, or
like,
lard.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the high, like anything kind of frozen, it's like high heat.
Or like Facebook. It looks like you're having fun on your vacation. The reality of it is you fought the entire time and you got a sunburn.
Oh my goodness. It's so true. It's so true. I love, like, I mean, so much of this movie was about showing off. Like, that scene with the apples and the banquet, like, where they're, like, throwing the apples and they're, like, I forget what was going on there.
Yeah, what
happens? Can you talk about this scene? It's when Dr. Evil was, you know, sort of like entering with this harem of, you know, women and And then they're like, they were like throwing apples in the air, and then they're like hitting them with like.
And they had like ninja stars that they're throwing. Oh, yeah. Darts. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And they do not miss.
No.
And they're throwing it above the heads of the banquet crowd. Like
it's like they're doing all kinds of tricks. Yeah. Oh,
friendly fire. Where'd you get that scar? Oh, I went to dinner.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, to be fair, if you're like going to a dinner on some crazy island with like a bunch of kung fu you know, you're probably
probably getting some kind of entertainment.
You bought the ticket. Get on the ferry.
Yeah, get on the ferry. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Well, I was going to say that I wanted to sort of quickly talk about, that scene that like stood out to me at the very beginning when Williams was trying to like head to the airport, I guess, and like these cops stop him.
Oh, yeah, and the cops are fucking with him.
No reason. And like just didn't want him to like go to Hong Kong, I guess.
Yeah.
Or, like,
Yeah, I mean, and again, you know, this was 1973, so like, you know, I think there was a lot of, racial tension, you know, happening during the time, and you know, I think this was a good depiction of, you know, someone being harassed by the police, and you know, idealistically, in terms of like a hero, you know, in this movie, he was able to, you know, fight them and these corrupt cops that were just trying to simply hurt him for no reason. He was able to fight them and get away, right? So. You know, it's kind of like an idealized version of like what you would envision would happen. Obviously, in reality, you'd probably get arrested and you know whatnot.
Or shot.
It's shot. Right. Right. Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Doesn't he flee in the cop car?
He does. Yeah. He does flee.
He comes up and I'm going to take the cop car to the airport.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they've already seen his passport and everything, so they could ID him.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right.
That's when you just have to go ahead and finish it.
Yeah.
If you know what I'm saying.
I mean, I was definitely like surprised, you know. I like you said, like it was kind of this idealized moment. But, you know, it's like not much has changed in terms of like you know, bad cops just, you know, fucking around for no reason being racist. And it's like, wow, like we were, it was happening in the 70s. It's happening today.
Sure.
It was just so poignant that moment. It's a small part of the movie. Like he doesn't, the crazy thing about Williams is like, he doesn't make a big deal of it. Like he doesn't,
tell anybody.
I know. It's like, I was like, oh my God, these cops.
Damn thing happened.
Yeah. He was like, well, I'm going to Hong Kong and I'm going to go do some kung fu.
I was thinking about that too. Like maybe it could have even be seen as like a personal affront to these cops that this black guy had a ticket to travel internationally. Like he's carrying the Pan Am bag, you know, and it's like, oh, who do you think you are going to Hong Kong? Like,
yeah, and I think they said something like, "You're not going to Hawaii, right?" It was very, you know, I think they're trying to drive that point home. Yeah.
Right. Wow. Killjoy.
Yeah, and that's really what I like about this movie overall. They have like a lot of really strong underlying messages, and it's like, you know, like I said, given that it's 1973, there's, you know, heightened political climate, and I don't think that's really ever died down, right? But you know, there's a lot of strong messages in this movie, you know, in terms of, you know, I think like communal family understanding and family responsibility, especially around you know, African and Asian cultures. Yep. With his sister.
Right.
And taking on that dutiful responsibility. There's, you know, a deeper idea of, you know, training hard and, you know, focusing your mind and, you know, you know, I think this was greater education for, you know, Asian African people as well, even in America, just to have that focus type of training. You know, I think he really exhibited that in his movies as well. So I think that you know, it gave a lot of people drive, right? I mean, I can single-handedly name a lot of people that, you know, watch his films and said, hey, you know, I'm going to try martial arts after this, right? I mean, that's a big deal, right? Hey, get up off your TV, get up off your couch, and let's go be active.
Uh-huh.
I I did find out, you know, the scene with the praying mantises, where they were like, so kind of like betting.
They were watching them like a dog fight, but it was with an insect.
Yeah.
On the boat, but right?
Evidently, they were flown in from Hawaii, these praying mantises, and they refused to fight each other.
They found pacifist killer insects.
Oh, it warmed my...
So how'd they get them to fight?
I think it was just kind of like... I'd have to go back and look at it, but I don't think... I think that they were just suggesting... you might know this a little bit more than me, but I know they were talking about bedding and they showed them the praying mantises, but I don't know if they were really like, how does a praying mantis fight anyway? What does that even look like? I don't know.
Yeah.
You know?
I know I think the female consumes the male, but I don't know about them like actually
during mating, right?
I think during mating. Yeah, that's what it is. Sure.
Brutal. I'm just really glad that the kitty cat didn't die. I was really worried for the cat and the decapitation.
You
don't remember the guillotine part with
I don't remember that either.
Oh, yes.
What was
it? It's like a trap door into another layer.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Put your head into this guillotine. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, and then, what? So... You don't trust me?
Yeah.
Look, I lay my own precious cat into this. Yeah, you also have one hand, motherfucker.
Yeah, and you have this crazy island of, like, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
A sociopath. Yeah.
It's like a pre Epstein island. Yeah.
Oh man, I did feel that Williams. I don't know how. Like, was he kind of veering into stereotype territory? I mean, he was definitely like this very cool, you know, dude, very suave and like a ladies'
man. Big fro, great clothes, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think he was a great character. And of course, movies stereotype all the time, you know.
Right.
But I don't know.
But not as much as Blazing Saddles, which would have been around the same time. And, like, they played with, like, racist humor in that. Where it's like, there was racial representation in this, but it didn't.
Yeah, and Williams was supposed to be... It was, like, over the top. I think he was supposed to be involved in a lot of the... he was an activist, I think, is the... maybe part of his character. So it kind of makes sense that he's kind of like, you know, into certain like looks and aesthetics and
I think in the beginning of the film he was like in a dojo, right? And it was like a it seemed like a Pan-African liberation type dojo. I mean, they had the like a lot of the red, black and green. I don't know if you guys remember that. And they were like so I think you're right, Aaron.
This kind of makes me want to look at the kind of trajectory of martial arts films and how they started and how they evolved and like what was the golden age of it, but because there's definitely a market. Like, did they discover, you know, how did this happen? I'm sure there's writings on this.
That's a
YouTube
good
video out there for it, I'm sure. So, you know what I thought? I found this out about the set design, because it was a pretty elaborate the construction of it all. And this I thought was really interesting. Evidently, so they had a kind of a limited budget, as one does on a movie set sometimes. Mm-hmm. And you know, things were built out of like chicken wire and mud and wood chips, you know. So they needed to make these steel bars for their prison cells. Mm-hmm. And they made them by shaving down pieces of scrap wood because that was cheaper than buying round pieces of wood, which boggles my mind. Like a dowel rod was more expensive than paying somebody to like shave it down, you know, slowly. Isn't that just wild to me.
That is pretty wild.
That seems like a lot of labor is making your own dowel rods.
That can't be right. I know. Yeah. It's like,
okay,
golly.
So I have a curiosity about this film. So down when the villain or the antagonist is showing Bruce Lee that his operations downstairs, he's showing like women behind bars, and then these men that he says, oh, we've just gathered these guys up, they're alcoholics, they're wastoids, and and we're doing, what the fuck were they doing with them? Were they doing like drug experiments on them? Because there were also like these giant vats of some kind of goo,
like,
that they
like
were cooking.
Acid
and I was like,
something,
is that
right?
Supposed to be
was,
drug manufacturing?
I think that's what it was. I think that's what it was. I think they were manufacturing drugs, and that's why, you know, they're getting all those, you know, his little harem of women like shoot up all the time. And yeah,
okay.
I think they're making
so,
drugs.
I mean,
I believe. Yeah,
that's some kind of outrageous nefari. What is the word?
Nefarious.
Nefarious.
Yep. Yep.
Oh, like activity that, like, we're like, I'm wondering if that's what Middle America thought like drugs were about. Like, yeah, let's get all these guys together and like just turn them into like drug addicts. Like,
yeah.
Like, what's the business plan here? Like, how does this benefit anyone?
Yeah.
You know, no, it's just evil.
It's just pure evil. Yeah. I mean, that's basically Sackler 101, I guess. You know? So,
right.
I mean,
exactly.
It kind of happened, but not quite in that way. But yeah, and I thought the girls were being drugged so that they could get, you know, hooked on. You know,
yeah.
They could become now, addicts and then
that's
like, sex
a solid
slaves.
Business plan. But why are you getting like, yeah, what are you doing with these drunk guys? Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe you know, there's a lot of punishment in this movie, like the guards that were.
Oh, right.
Like they didn't do their jobs where they, you know, let somebody wander the premises at night. So then they basically got kung fu to death because they were obviously they're not the most skilled of all of the
oh right if
the
they
island.
Failed yeah
yeah mm-hmm. But poor things, you know, I mean they're doing their best and all of a sudden, you know, here they are on the chopping block literally.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
but,
well
yeah.
That's the deal. If you're like, if you're hanging out with gangsters, like there's no moral code, like yeah, you're going to get treated poorly, too. It's only a matter of time.
I did want to bring up, and on this philosophy, which I'm sure that you're familiar with Bruce Lee, that has a sort of using water as a metaphor for kind of like how to live your life. And I know you've used water in kind of metaphorical ways in your work as well. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it said something about like using water as like basically like to be formless or shapeless and to basically be able to move into, you know, different ways of thought, different ways of being as formlessly as water. So that's what I, you know, I also mean by like a lot of his quotes were like really, really fantastic in terms of just being able to take these and apply it to your life and say, hey, this makes a lot of sense, honestly, right? In my own work, it's in my own personality, it's just, you know, having to adapt, you know, right here in America, right now I use water as kind of a metaphor for black and brown people and like our own migration and movement as a people. And also, just having to enter different situations, different countries, different places where, you assimilate authentically, right? Mm-hmm. You make it your own. You take your own culture and you build up your own society, and to kind of have that resonate with other people is really powerful as well. You know, for instance, I just displayed this solo show about, you know, water down in Lubbock, Texas, at Charles Adams Gallery, and it was really fantastic to see people that I don't want to say they're like landlocked, right? I mean, it's not huge bodies of water, but to kind of, you know, see that resonate and permeate, you know, with them as well. And also just this idea of like transference and culture and like how, you know, we are reflective of that. So, you know, how water is treated, how it's valued in our society, you know, if you think about it, we can't live without it, right? We can't go, what, 4, 5, 6 days without it, we're dead, right? But at the same time, so there's so much value in it. But at the same time, you know, we let companies, these private corporations, poison it with oil, and we say, oh well, you know, hopefully that'll get corrected, right? While we stand back and not do too much, right? But it's kind of like a parallel of black and brown people and how we're treated in this country, right? Our ideas are taken from, we're extremely valued, you know, we've nourished this country, we've helped, you know, in a lot of instances with black people, they've literally built this country, but then they're you know, that them and we were simply discarded. Right, just like water. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of these parallels that happen. So the migration, whether forceful or non-forceful, whether we're put in situations where it's like post-colonialism, where you know you have to leave a certain place, right? It's all parallel to this movement that you experience with water. So you know, when Bruce Lee said, you know, be like water making its way through the cracks, you find a way around it or through it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, the way that you mentioned how, you know, how a society treats its water is indicative of how it treats, you know, its people and the conditions of certain people who maybe don't have as many resources. And it just, like here in Dallas, I mean, we're just so, like, I just look around and I'm like, it's just, it's very frustrating to see how we use water so irresponsibly. You know, it's like we're in a desert, basically. Like, but it doesn't look like it in some neighborhoods because, you know, we're using drinking water to water, like, lawns and stuff. But I could probably talk for another hour about Dallas and how frustrating it is here. As you know, Adnan, you look around and you're like, ugh. Silly humans, you know.
Yeah, definitely. So,
yeah, but your work does have like watery qualities. I mean, I think, what's the medium that you use?
Oh yeah, is no, great question. So right now, my latest body of work, what I'm doing, it's more of a project. I'm going to different locations throughout the world, and I basically lay linen down on the beach, and then so water will hit it for like 2 or 3 hours, and sand and sediment will hit it. Then I'll take it back to my studio, and I'll basically seal it all, and then I use that as like a grounding to, I then frame the piece, and then I use that to paint on it. So right now I've been making these blue paintings. They're acrylic, oil, sand and sediment, and then I hand embroider cotton in there as well. So it's you know, just really exploring mediums. I had a lot of, you know, really good mentors and stuff, and they just kind of, they're like, you know, what you're doing is great, but you really need to push your understanding of like how you utilize materials and you know, what that even means, right? So I you know, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, I started giving that really serious thought as to you know, what's the story of, you know, every step of this painting? You know, what does this material mean? Why am I using it? Like you know, so through kind of discovering that, I've been going to, you know, I did 2 paintings in Surfside Beach, Texas. I did 2 in Oceanside, California. I did 2 in Destin, Florida, and then I did 2 at the Dead Sea in Jordan, and then I did 1 big one in Chicago, Illinois, and that one I made it light blue. Like the others, I made them all the same color blue. And what's really cool about these pieces is the main thing that's different between them is the location, and you see that through the sediment in the background that, you know, it's painted upon. And
that is so cool.
Thank you.
Yeah, is that on your Instagram?
Yeah, it is on my Instagram.
So, like a forensics person could break down one of your paintings chemically and maybe find different, like mineral compounds.
100% exactly
that are preserved in the. paint. Yeah.
100%. Exactly. Yeah. Like, for instance, the one that I did at the Dead Sea, it has nothing but rare minerals and sediment in there. So, like, literally, like, when I was bringing it back from overseas, I got, like, interrogated by airport security. I got interrogated by the chief of police. And they're like, you are not taking our mud, are you? And I was just like, no, definitely not, even though I had, like, a whole bag of it. It was great. You know, it was really great. Each painting is it's a journey. It's an experience. There's a narrative associated with it, and there's a history to it.
Yeah,
that's amazing. I'm such a big fan of exploring different media and experimenting with something unconventional. Mm-hmm. So I totally dig
agreed.
That
language. That is It's so interesting. Mm-hmm. Crossing borders with material like that too.
Yes.
Because I know, you know, one of the questions you get is, were you on a farm while you were visiting because of like animal diseases being transferred from one country to the next?
Oh, wow.
Or like seeds or like exotic animals. Like, you know, like there are people that like smuggle birds in tubes and things like that. I mean, it's highly illegal. But it's interesting to think about taking something inert like mud, like just
wait a minute, like, hi, am I not supposed to be taking seeds to my mother in Portugal? Is this not a good idea? I swear to God, every time I go, she's like, can you bring me some jalapeno seeds? And I'm like, lady, are you sure? Am I gonna get arrested? Like, it's not worth it.
You definitely don't want to put jalapeno seeds in a body cavity and smuggle them.
I'm gonna write that down and remember to tell
don't let her turn you into a seed mule.
It's that, and then I always have to bring her Tylenol because it's expensive overseas. Makes me really nervous how much I take of it here, like it's candy, and I'm like, wait, it's like $10 over there for like a small bottle. And I'm like, what am I putting in my body? But anyway,
no, that's awesome.
Is there anything else you wanted to mention about the movie, Anon, or anything that
we haven't talked about? No, this is really just like a great experience. I mean, I could talk about water all day. I think like ecology is like really, really important, like especially in America and in the world, right? Like it's something we're facing and we're kind of battling, you know, every day to make like our world and you know, the water just like better, right? So that's kind of my main, you know, goal with the work, and also just like you know, transference of like new ideas and you know, just like we said with like the Bruce Lee quote of like embracing, you know, new things and that parallel to water. You know, another thing I've been doing is I've been kind of diving into like motion art, and I've been doing that collaboratively with Taylor Cleveland. He's a really great you know, motion video artist here in Dallas as well, and you know, he has shows, you know, throughout Dallas. So we've been kind of doing this collaborative project where you know, we're using these water forms to, you know, digitally make them move as well. So you know, just be on the lookout for that. Cool. So it's really cool.
Well, thank you for being on the podcast. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that I'm not a Bruce Lee virgin anymore. And I finally watched one of these movies, because I don't think I would have done that if you hadn't requested this movie. I really enjoyed it. I didn't think I would. I was But it was fun to watch. It really was.
No, I'm so happy you're able to watch it. And I was really happy to speak with both of you. You both had just such cool insights. And I think this is just a fantastic project you're both doing.
Thank you.
Well,
we like it. So.
It's great. It's great to have you on.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And folks, listeners out there, I think this movie's on HBO. If you have HBO, you can watch it for free.
Ah.
Or rent it. You know.
Like, yeah. And Adnan, your show in Lubbock is up.
That's right.
How long?
Yeah. So thank you. That is going on till August 1st.
Yeah, at the Charles Adams Gallery. Yeah.
Yep.
Is that a commercial gallery? Is it attached to the university or?
So it's attached to the university, but it is a commercial gallery. I think they have like a project space and then commercial gallery space.
So it's part of Texas Tech?
I believe the studio space is, I think. I'm not 100% sure, but yeah.
Just trying to help people find it.
yeah. No, it's I believe it's a part of... Texas Tech's program. I think they have some kind of joint relationship with the Charles Adams Studio Project. Okay. And then there's the private commercial gallery. So I'm showing it in the private commercial gallery. Yeah.
Yeah. I would love it, too, if you sent Aaron a link to the Bruce Lee, like, philosophy text.
Sure. Yeah,
so that maybe we could include a link to that.
Definitely. I think we could all use a little Bruce Lee philosophy. Minus the, I don't know if y'all, I did find this out really quickly that he was on set of this movie. He kept a jar of brownies and cannabis and
He was high the weeds, whole time. Yeah. Good man.
Filming this. Yeah. So there you go.
Wow.
You know. I know. I'm like, brownies? No way.
At first you said like a jar of brownies and cannabis. And I was like, wait, what?
He was like, using cannabis.
Super into getting high. Yeah.
Like in between. It's crazy. I mean, you know, good for him to like, wow. Well,
For some people, it really helps him get into a zone. For me, it doesn't do that for me.
Sure. Well, sure.
I'd be like, you wanted to hit me? Fine.
I wouldn't be able to keep a straight face. I'd be laughing the whole time. But I mean,
it'd be a very different movie.
Which I think this movie
to perform martial arts. Yeah.
Like, you know, this is great. You know, you want to fight, but we're on a beach right now, so.
Yeah. Oh, my
right.
goodness.
Right. Dude, chill out. Yeah.
Well, thanks again, Anand. We look forward to seeing more of your work on Instagram. And
thank you so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you both. I appreciate your time. Yeah.
All right. Good luck. Hope to meet you sometime.
Definitely. Yeah. Looking forward to it. Sounds good. All right. Take care, guys.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
It is like a finger pointing away to the moon. Don't concentrate on the finger or you will miss all that heavenly glory.